We are joined here live in the KODX studios by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I had a great time kayaking in here.
Wow. I didn't even think about that.
No, I know. This time of year, I sometimes will wake up from having, in the morning, from having a long dream of swimming down the street to get to work.
I can explain that.
But, you know, this year we had a really dry November, and usually November is a very wet month for us.
Yeah, so usually we get this kind of soaking rain at the beginning of November, end of October.
Yeah, so it's looking like we're getting all of November's rain and December's rain in 1 week here, and that's causing a lot of flooding.
Yep.
And a lot of hazardous situations out there for people throughout the Puget Sound. So just remember, obey street signs that say road closed. Do not try to drive into a lake.
And especially if the sign says road closed and it's like halfway underwater when you see it. You know, I mean, that's like a clue.
Your four-wheel drive will not save you.
No. Yeah, and if you live in a low area, you may want to take some precautions if you haven't already. In case water is rising, and pay attention to the weather forecasts and for warnings of rising water.
Yeah.
And if you need to evacuate, you know, get your go bag ready to go and be prepared.
The rain is supposed to tail off this afternoon, so we'll see.
We'll see.
But just in time for Christmas, flotation devices are great gifts.
Yes, they are.
So something to consider.
And happy holidays to all our listeners.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
We'll promote that again at the end. All right, so plenty happening this week, starting out with item related to the homeless.
Yeah, Erica Barnett in her invaluable blog, The Seas for Crank, had a scoop this week because she put a public records request in and got a hold of emails from the mayor's office to Jason Johnson, who's the acting director of HSD, basically requesting a study or a feasibility study on how the city could use biometrics to require biometrics to gather data on the homeless population they serve. So they want to require homeless folks to essentially surrender their privacy and get thumbprinted and a few other things possibly in order to receive services, essential shelter or food or anything like that. And it really is striking because, number one, there's no nobody can figure out why this would help the city more deliver services more efficiently. It seems more punitive than anything else, and it's a really slippery slope. I mean, what's next? Chips or tattoos? Or it really seems like you're singling out a vulnerable population. It's dependent on you for services and really harassing them in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Now, very, very disturbing.
Now, sorry. I'm sure the mayor and Jason Johnson and other members of the Durkin administration justify it by saying that, well, you know, we want to weed out people who have a criminal record from the homeless population. They went homeless. They're trying to get services under a false name, et cetera, et cetera. But you know what? Our society criminalizes a lot of things that it shouldn't. And people with a criminal record should not necessarily be penalized for the rest of their life and excluded from being offered housing and offered a chance to work a straight job and to get their lives back into shape. And that's what our society often does. And by using biometrics to try to screen out those people or separate them out from the quote-unquote innocent homeless, I think that
Deserving homeless.
The deserving homeless, yeah. I think that really perpetuates that lifelong punishment that we enact against people who have slipped in the past.
And a lot of people who get out of prison or get out of jail don't have anywhere to go.
They
don't have money. They don't have housing. And there are some programs for that, but
there's
demand
not
vastly,
enough funding for
the demand vastly exceeds the need, as is true with most homeless services. So the other thing that occurred to me is this is a way that obviously a lot of homeless people and a lot of homeless service providers are likely to refuse that kind of a program. And, you know, that's a great way for the city to say, see, there's fewer people needing our services. We're reducing the homeless population. And that seems to be really the end goal of most of the city's policies. And we'll talk about that in underreported stories also.
And this has been this particular program with biometrics. The use, potential use of biometrics, is new. But the city has tried this in the past with homeless populations to keep data on them, require data from them to be included in certain programs. And there's been pushback every time, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's correct. Although some of that came from federal requirements to get funding, so that's not necessarily the city's fault. But this definitely is Durkin, and it's a reflection of the priorities of this mayor, which, I mean, this kind of a initiative really should be disqualifying from her for office. And, you know, she's up for re-election in 2021, and people who want to see a serious candidate try to unseat her need to start thinking about who that might be and need to think about where the money might come from to raise.
Yeah, and that's
now.
Yeah, that's going to have to start this coming year.
Yep, absolutely. Early this coming year.
Mm-hmm. All right. Excuse me. So moving along to one of our state representatives that got some, in his eyes, I'm sure, some unwanted additional attention this week.
Yeah, the House of Representatives had an investigation into Matt Shea, a Republican from Spokane Valley, who is... shall we say, outspoken in his right-wingism. It turns out that he played a key role in the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge takeover by a bunch of armed patriots, quote-unquote, in 2017. He was in the middle of that. And he also played a key role in helping to organize the Bundy standoff in Nevada in I think 2016. He also was involved previous to that in a standoff between right-wing patriots and law enforcement in northern Idaho in 2014. So he has a long record of associating with violent extremists, basically. This has not endeared him to House. The House Republicans had already kicked him out of their caucus. They've taken additional steps this week to try and distance themselves from him. They've taken him off the state website. He doesn't have an office right now. It's not clear in the coming legislative session where his office will be, because there isn't a whole lot of room in the office buildings in Olympia to house him, basically. It takes a two-thirds vote of the House in order to expel a member who has been elected. And it's entirely possible, given the Democratic majority, you would only need about 13 or so Republicans to vote to expel him as well before he'd be out of office, which he really needs to be. We're really talking about criminal behavior here. We're talking about sedition, basically. And he's been advocating that kind of thing for a long, long time. Not necessarily in Washington State, you notice, but in other parts of the West. And, hopefully there are those Republican votes. Shea has been in the House for, I believe, about 10 years, so he's got a lot of buddies. But he also, there's also plenty of Republicans who don't want to be associated with this kind of thing, no matter how off the rails they might be ideologically. They don't want to be associated with the term domestic terrorist. And that is basically what they called Matt Shea in this report. So, we'll see what the House can do between now and when the legislative session starts, and when the legislative session starts, that may be one of their first orders of priority.
I know he isn't currently, but he was one of the former state chairpersons for ALEC, so he has some rich history there with shaping some corporate legislation here in the state.
Very much so, and also a lot of culture war kind of stuff that he's introduced, mostly not successfully, but he's very noisy about it.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch that, and especially given that as you had pointed out online, some of the demonstrations that have happened in Olympia previously with people who are for pro carrying firearms there in the state capitol.
I was talking to a former lobbyist this week who had expressed a real concern, and he certainly was expressing this to other people as well, about the security down there, because the Senate chambers have metal detectors and screening processes before you can go into the gallery there. The House does not, similar to City Hall, which does not. And it really is time for most of these legislative bodies to take the kind of precautions that, for example, the King County Courthouse had to take after a tragedy in the mid-90s when a husband who was being divorced in a divorce proceeding up and shot his wife. That's why we have metal detectors in the King County Courthouse. And given the tenor of the times, I think it's really past time that City Hall and the State House consider that, those kind of measures as well.
All right.
Shea has plenty of supporters that have concealed carry permits, and they will show up to support him.
All right. I want to point out, just before we get on to the next item for National, that this time of year we traditionally start weaving into our broadcasts the most overhyped and underreported stories of the year that you both have been collecting.
Yes, it's a holiday tradition.
It is.
Yes, it is.
Because usually the holidays are kind of a dead time for news, but
not
nothing
so much
nothing really happened in D.C. this week, but but we'll talk about it anyway.
Yeah. So this week we're going to start with the local, and next week we'll cover national and international. But we're getting the happenings of the week out of the way first. That includes local and national, and then we'll get to the overhyped and underreported local stories.
Yes.
All right. So that can then take us on to national and developments. Impeachment.
The rumor has it that Donald Trump has now been impeached. It goes to the Senate now, and the surprise was that Nancy Pelosi announced immediately after impeachment that she was going to hold the articles of impeachment and not send them over to the Senate until she got assurances from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell that he would conduct a fair trial, which is the constitutional responsibility of the Senate. McConnell has said, number one, that he could not be an impartial juror, and number two, that he was working closely with Trump's lawyers in order to shape how the Senate trial would unfold, now, or if it would unfold. Now, this is roughly analogous to the foreperson of a jury announcing to the judge that, I'm working with the defense team. It's staggering. It is there's no precedent for this at all in terms of what McConnell is doing. And so Pelosi is leveraging what she can to try and forestall that, which is good for her, because she may or may not send those articles over to the Senate. It's really going to be a face-off between her and McConnell, and they're both very strong-willed.
Yeah. Early this week, I noticed that Chuck Schumer, the Democratic majority leader in the Senate, had sent over a proposal to Mitch McConnell saying, let's base the parameters of the trial on the trial that was conducted for Bill Clinton. Let's use the same standards.
Which McConnell was a key person in.
Yeah, let's use the same standards, you know. And the Clinton trial happened over about 5 weeks, and there were witnesses and there was testimony, and there was evidence heard. And
the parameters for that trial were agreed on by the Democrats and Republicans.
And the Republicans.
And passed 100-0.
And it was done in a very bipartisan manner. And McConnell just rejected those out of hand and said, oh, no, I'm going to work with the White House, and we're going to make this a speedy trial, and we're not going to hear evidence, and we're not going to have witnesses. And you know, I'm going to work with the president's lawyers to try to figure out what's best for President Trump, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah. And as soon as I saw that, I just thought, okay, well, you know, essentially we're probably not going to have it's going to be a show trial. But what will be interesting for me to see is how Donald Trump responds to whatever Mitch McConnell proposes in the Senate. Because Trump has this habit of looking at what's proposed, whether it's proposed by a Republican or a Democrat, and just saying, no, that's not what I want. I want X. And it may be good for him personally, and it may not. So he may look at the proposals of a speedy trial that are meant to get it out of the way and out of the nation's conscience, well, consciousness well before the early returns in the presidential campaigns come in the early states. And he may say, no, I want a prolonged trial where I get to have my say and I get to.
Yeah. And he has said that he wants witnesses and he wants this trial.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see if what his lawyers and what Mitch McConnell come up with is something that Donald Trump just vetoes and says, nope, I want to do something that's actually going to hurt me, but that makes me feel better.
And he has been increasingly erratic and under pressure the past couple of weeks. And so the other wild card in this, I think, is what he might do between now and when the Senate reconvenes. It would make things worse. And also, of course, the investigation is still ongoing. And there's still plenty of investigative journalism that's digging up stuff, too, which I'll get to in a minute. So we may have a lot more information on the Ukraine scheme or on other things, other crimes that Donald Trump has committed between now and the first January.
In the meantime, Rudy Giuliani is still working behind the scenes to try to get the Ukrainian government to investigate the Bidens. So there could be more crimes on the part of Donald Trump that are developing as well.
And that was one thing that the Democrats cited in terms of the urgency of passing the impeachment, because this is involving trying to cheat in the 2020 elections, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's an ongoing thing. And Donald Trump has been unrepentant about it. And that's one thing I noticed in the impeachment debate, in the debates leading up to it, is the Republicans were throwing everything at the wall that was disingenuous or flat out false in the hopes that something would stick. But that one thing they didn't do was defend Donald Trump's actions. And Trump is the one that's out there saying, I did nothing wrong. This the call in July was perfect, and so forth. He is probably going to be adamant that he wants a venue in which he can claim that nothing wrong was done.
And that he feels he may be vindicated in that claim. And that is probably not what's going to happen.
And part of the vindication that he's looking for is a ratification of the idea that the president is above the law.
Mm-hmm.
The president, by definition, can do nothing illegal.
Yeah.
And that that is not going to fly anywhere, except with other Republicans, of course.
Yeah.
So I didn't hear many predictions prior to Nancy Pelosi's decision to delay handing the whole process over to the Senate, that she would do that. I felt surprised when that.
She keeps her cards very close to the vest, and she's very savvy in terms of manipulating the process. So I was surprised at that particular gambit, but I was not surprised that she had something planned. And the other thing about that is that the rules for the trial only have to be passed by a simple majority. So it only takes four Republicans to agree with the Democrats that there should be a fair trial, or to agree with Trump that there should be a trial, in order for McConnell to be overridden. Mm-hmm. And that's the real point of leverage.
And again, only four Republicans to vote with the Democrats to convict Trump.
No, that's not true. Conviction requires
two-thirds. Okay. Conviction requires two-thirds.
So that would require about 20 Republicans.
Highly unlikely. But if there's a trial, and the trial shows that Trump really was, committed crimes, then it would be really, really difficult for Republicans to vote to exonerate him.
Oh, I don't think so. I think they're committed to exonerating him regardless. But I think the American public would be paying attention.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It could have implications for the election.
And if it drags if it drags on for weeks, I think we're going to see some stuff come up for the Republicans that they're going to feel the pain at the polls.
Yeah, and it also might influence the Democratic primaries, which start at the beginning of February. They're coming right up with the Iowa caucus.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very intriguing move there. curveball for me. It's also interesting, too, that the McConnell his devotion to the White House on this, publicly stating that, really seems to parallel Bill Barr's steerage of the Justice Department, you know, in doing exactly what's best for Trump and having nothing to do with what's best for
the Republican Party at this point is a personality cult. It is devoted to Trump and devoted, you know, they've got a conclusion and they're in search of a justification for it. Now, that conclusion has nothing to do with reality.
But this has been a trend for the Republican Party for a while, this divorce from reality.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's why even if Trump is removed, we've still got a problem on our hands. I saw Michael Moore give an interview this week where he was saying, really what needs to happen in 2020 is not just the Democrats taking the White House or even the White House and the Senate. The Republican Party needs to be destroyed in its current form.
And in the meantime, what that's doing to the Democratic Party is it's sending a lot of people who would ordinarily be reasonable Republicans over to the Democratic Party. And we're seeing this split in the party between progressive Democrats, who would be sort of your standard old school Roosevelt-style Democrats, represented by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, versus the people who are much more conservative. And I see someone like Pete Buttigieg really speaking to those folks, folks who would ordinarily be part of the Republican Party.
And Biden as well.
Yeah, and Joe Biden. Although at times it can be hard to tell what Biden
It can be hard to tell what he's speaking to.
He's
speaking to the angels dancing around his head.
Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, I think at this point, Pete Buttigieg has really pushed himself forward as the representative for the more conservative wing of the Democratic Party. Yeah. And he's really gaining steam in that regard. And I feel that a lot of those folks would be sort of mainstream Republicans if the Republican Party hadn't become so divorced from reality and so far right wing.
If the Republican Party that you and I grew up with still existed.
Still existed, yeah. Exactly.
All right. Also this week, a report out of Lawfare. What is Lawfare for those?
Lawfare is a very good legal journal, and often covers political issues as well from a legal perspective. And they had an investigative report this week on a company called The Soul Publishing. It is the third largest YouTube and Facebook media company in the world, after Disney and Warner. You may not have heard of it. They got something like 60 billion, that's with a B, billion unique page views last year. And much of it is through, I think their most known feature is something called 5-Minute Crafts. But it's all basically clickbait, and that's how they get the revenue as well. This is a company that's run out of Cyprus, the same country, that is notorious for laundering Russian oligarch money. And it's run by some Russian nationals. And it looks like, according to the Lawfare report, that the Soul Publishing also sponsored some pro-Trump ads during the 2018 campaign. And it looks like they're setting up to be a major conduit for Russian disinformation in the 2020 campaign. The way this works is you get a huge number of subscribers or viewers through clickbait, through things that appeal to people who are more credulous, shall we say, that more credulous population then gets hammered with pro-Trump propaganda in the 2020 election,
and they share and spread it.
And they spread it, yes. Mm-hmm. This is probably should go in our underreported stories of the year. It's really a staggering operation, and much more potentially much more influential than anything Russia did in 2016. So it's a little frightening that way. And of course, the U.S. government has done nothing to try and counter Russian disinformation in the years since 2016. Because Donald Trump thinks that's just fine. So that's something to look for in the coming year. Also this week, Facebook shut down a network of over 600 fake AI-generated profiles traced back to the publication Epoch Times. Now, Epoch Times is something that people may be familiar with because they have newsstands around Seattle and other major cities. It is got an enormous amount of funding. It's basically a publication of the Falun Gong movement in China. But it is very virulently anti-communist and very virulently pro-Trump and tends to traffic in a lot of conspiracy theories. And so this is something that Facebook did after getting a lot of reports and a lot of complaints that this was going on, that these sites were already pushing pro-Trump propaganda. And we'll see if Facebook continues to try and clean up some of these networks, because they certainly didn't in 2016, and hopefully they will they'll be a little more vigilant this time around.
And managed to not capture legitimate political discourse at the same time, which I know has been an issue for them in the past.
It has, and it's also a function of their algorithms. Mm-hmm. That the stuff that's most provocative, that again is most likely to be clickbait, gets into more people's feeds.
Well, and because I see plenty of that on amongst my social media friends, connections. Mm-hmm. The proliferation of certain content that, there's enough people that just seem to go with a headline and just assume that the headline is good, and then they don't even click on the article. And then if you do click on the article, it's like it really starts to fall apart, you know, if you actually read the details or follow the links to where they originated from.
So, well, that's because we've done journalism and we know to look for sources and things like that. Mm-hmm. And
how to evaluate sources.
And how to evaluate sources. So,
and that's something that's not taught to people, whether you're in school or you're in college, or even the mainstream media has a hard time teaching that to people because it feeds itself off of clicks and eyes and advertising based on how many readers you have. And so the headlines in mainstream media can be provocative and misleading as well.
Yeah. And media literacy has been a problem in this country for decades, mm-hmm. but it's becoming increasingly urgent right now, because you've got a whole segment of the population that basically believes whatever they read. Mm-hmm. And that has directly led to the rise of Trump, I think.
And believe what you read, you know, when it flashes by your screen for a quarter of a second before, you know, the Twitter feed it reboots itself automatically and shoves something else in front of your eyes. It's really kind of overwhelming.
Yeah, it's a fire hose for sure.
Yeah,
and you know, really, I would encourage anybody listening to this who to pay attention to what the sources are. If it's something that doesn't seem to add up, it probably doesn't.
I would encourage people to, you know, find a source you trust, evaluate your news sources, find a source you trust. Don't just get your news from Facebook or Twitter. You know, find a source you trust, go directly to their website, you know, on a daily basis or subscribe to a publication on a daily basis and get yourself informed. And then you have tools for evaluating the stuff you see on Twitter and Facebook and saying, that doesn't sound right to me.
Yeah.
You know, because I think it really starts with having a good source or two as your anchor point.
And I would encourage people to get out of the left-wing bubble.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Also.
Don't just stay in the left-wing bubble. Find a mainstream news source. And you can complain about how the mainstream news source treats various topics and issues, but it does provide at least an anchor point for you for evaluating things that you see on Facebook.
Yeah, and the and you know, Twitter. The big corporate sites, they do have fact checkers.
Mm-hmm.
They do try to traffic anyway, and it's not to say that they don't have their own biases.
Mm-hmm.
They do, but and try and figure out what those biases are and take them into account. But try and traffic in facts. Trying to traffic in verifiable reality.
Yeah.
Because that seems to be less and less relevant in our political
discourse.
And it's
harder and harder now.
As best you can. And I will admit, I, you know, regularly, I don't know how often it is, but regularly, you know, will click on something and post something that I later regret They go, okay, yeah, you're right. That really had no basis in reality at all.
I've done that too.
So, but I
try not to do it.
Yeah, after you get hit a couple times, and you know, in a given year with that, it's like
I just really spend less time on Facebook and Twitter than most people. So
that's actually probably a really good idea.
Fallen into that trap.
It is.
And my life's too busy for spending hours on Facebook.
Good New Year's resolution.
I post quite a bit on Facebook, but I definitely don't get my news there.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
So, there was also this week another Democratic debate. I guess the last one of the year.
The last one of the year. I believe it's the last one before the Iowa caucuses. There's another one in January.
No, there's two. They said that there would be the Democratic National Committee announced two in January, two in February. Those four are going to be each in one of the early states, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina.
Right. Okay.
And they're raising the requirements. So far, right, only five candidates have qualified for the January debate, and that's your top three: Warren, Sanders, and Biden, plus Buttigieg and Klobuchar.
Right. And this particular debate that was held on Wednesday, I believe. Mm-hmm. It was on Thursday.
Thursday. Yeah.
Had only seven, which was the smallest debate so far. The most notable person who was not in the debate was Cory Booker, who says he thinks he can still qualify for the January debate, but it will be an uphill struggle. And there's still quite a few other Democrats who are still running. The DNC is really trying to thin the field, I think. And we probably will see more people drop out before Iowa simply because they're running out of money. And they're not getting the exposure that these debates provide. The debate on Wednesday was interesting. The smaller number of people on the stage meant that there was more time to answer questions, and so they got more in-depth into questions. And it was a much more substantive debate than we've seen to date. And really, all seven candidates, I thought, were really articulate and were really on their game. To my surprise, I think the two people who did best were Klobuchar and Andrew Yang. Sanders got the most speaking time, and he did quite well. Buttigieg got quite a bit of speaking time as well, and he did well, as did Warren, who was number three, and Klobuchar, who was number two in terms of speaking time. Surprisingly, Biden was number five in terms of speaking time, even though he's still leading in the national polls. And he really wasn't targeted by the other candidates the way he has been in past debates. This time, the main target was Pete Buttigieg, who handled the sort of direct attacks on him by other candidates pretty well, I thought. But they've all been on the stump for months now, so they've got their answers down, and they've got their they're pretty representative of what you're going to get at this point. So I would encourage people to watch the debate, or one of the debates in January, because they are, at this point, one of these people is going to be the Democratic nominee and is going to take on Trump. And we need to decide which one. And Washington State comes the week after Super Tuesday this year. So we still have a say.
The second Tuesday in March. Yep. So much earlier than in the past when we were late May, right?
Yes, and deeply irrelevant most years.
Yeah, so there will be some shakeout before we get a chance to vote. But now's the time to look at the top candidates and determine who you will vote for if it narrows down to two or three of them.
Yeah, because at this point, they're not likely to change what they're saying.
Yeah.
So, what you see is what you get.
I'm curious, how did the media folks who were doing the questions perform this time around?
It was sponsored by PBS and Politico. The main moderator was Judy Woodruff, who, of course, is a very mainstream and very seasoned D.C. reporter. And I thought she was awful, personally, particularly the last question, which was, the frivolous personal question that seems to be a standard in some of these debates. It really was a waste of time, given that you know, you only have a limited amount of time with these candidates on stage, and you want to find out where they stand.
Did you see the moderators trying to get the candidates to attack each other, as I've seen in past debates?
Not so much as in past debates. Mm-hmm. The candidates were doing that themselves. but the moderators weren't doing that, and they were asking substantive questions mostly.
Okay.
So that part was okay.
So it's worth if you haven't checked out any of the Democratic debates in the past, you think this one would be a good one for people to stream online?
I do, or watch the next one, or the one after that in late January.
As the choice narrows down?
As the choice narrows down, the messages are getting honed. It's much more representative of you know, what they're going to be standing for in these primaries and when they come to Washington State. So it's time to start picking and choosing.
All right. Well, with that, unless I'm missing something here, then we're going to move on to our yearly
overhyped and underreported stories.
Should we mention that KODX is volunteer supported? And if you find the information, you get on this and many other programs. And incidentally, with the new expanded lineup, this is rebroadcast on Sunday morning at 9 o'clock.
It is
Monday evening at 5 o'clock.
Six o'clock.
So if Saturday afternoon's not a good time for you, and you don't easily get a podcast, which we're also available on podcast, you can check us out at one of those other times as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it still amazes me how many people don't know that we have a podcast of this, mm-hmm. as that you can find on iTunes as well as on our website, kodxseattle.org. And I had something else to
Remember us in your yearly giving. We are a 501c3, and if you make regular donations at the end of the year, please go to our website at kodxseattle.org and make a contribution.
Yeah, and the 501c3 and our fiscal sponsor actually is Earth on the Air Independent Media.
That's who you'd be making checks out to.
And you would send those checks to
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145. You can find that info on the website as well. Mm-hmm. And we're also, while we're plugging different ways people can get to the show, we're also available via TuneIn now, which is exciting because that reaches out to a lot of people that wouldn't find us otherwise. You can actually search us via their feature, and hoping to get some more ears that way.
So. Yeah.
Our empire keeps expanding.
I think that's a generous description. Anyway, so on to our most overhyped local stories. Number one on my list is big corporate donations for affordable housing. After the employee hours tax was defeated through a corporate push on the city council, a couple of big corporations, Microsoft and Amazon, announced that they were making pledges for affordable housing in Seattle, as if to say, hey, you guys don't have to tax us. We're going to do this voluntarily. But the problem with that is that the tax would have collected far more in money for affordable housing than what Microsoft and what Amazon proposed.
And it also leaves the what kind of affordable housing would be supported to the corporations.
Yeah, and it turned out that in the case of Microsoft and also in the case of Amazon, most of what they proposed would go into loans for people, money that would be paid back to the corporations, essentially just a way for them to invest their cash in an interest-bearing program that would pay them back with interest. And to build what's called workforce housing, generally defined as housing for people who make 80% of median income, not the folks who truly need more affordable housing in the city of Seattle, people who make less than 80% of median income.
Yeah, there is a shortage of 80% housing, median income housing in Seattle, but there's much more of a shortage of 30% and below.
Yeah,
and those are the folks you see on the street who can't get into housing because it's unaffordable, and there's the affordable housing that does exist is very, very competitive to get into.
So that was the most overhyped story this year, was that corporations are ponying up to build affordable housing and to contribute all this money, and we don't need an employee hours tax, when in fact that's not true.
And in fact, you know, the reason it's overhyped is that allies of those companies, not really thinking of anybody in particular, Seattle Times, but tend to hype those kind of donations as, you know, isn't this great that our corporate leaders are being all philanthropic and stuff? And no, actually, when you look at the details, it doesn't help that much.
Right.
And it doesn't really address the problem that we have.
And multiple media picked that up and ran with it for weeks, just like hyping it over and over, and like bumping up the numbers on it by saying, oh, we just found out something new about it this week. And then they'd add all the numbers together and go, it's even more for local homeless housing.
It's just way overhyped. And number two on my list.
And I would add to that also that when you have that kind of stuff in the media, that all this corporate money and all the city money is going into homelessness, it feeds the narrative when people are still living on the streets of the city isn't spending its money wisely. Why aren't we making progress?
So number two on my list is in April, Como News ran a conservative tough on crime editorial piece that they called Seattle is Dying. It focused on homelessness, drug use, and crime. Then the Seattle Times jumped on the bandwagon and ran their own editorial entitled Seattle's Persistent Crime Problem Demands Change. However, when you dug into the statistics on real crime in the city of Seattle, what you found is that crime was at a low compared to the 1980s, when crime was much higher in the city of Seattle. The one type of crime that was higher, that's been higher, is what's called larceny theft, which really turns out to be petty theft. In other words, shoplifting. And that businesses in the city of Seattle were pushing that message that, wow, there's a crime wave. There's a crime wave. Help. We need more policing. We need to push homeless people around, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, especially the Downtown Seattle Association.
Yeah, when in fact the crime rate is low. And so number three on
And we should mention also that Como, the TV station that originated that that meme, is owned by Sinclair Broadcasting, which is extremely conservative, pro-Trump, and requires
the Seattle Times.
Yes. Well, no. The Sinclair requires all of its affiliates, and it's one of the largest TV owners in the nation, to push this conservative programming that it
editorials
and editorials that it distributes nationally. So Como really isn't representative of Seattle and how Seattle thinks and how Seattle votes. But
I would argue the Seattle Times is not necessarily representative of how Seattle thinks and how Seattle votes either. They're also very conservative, and they also support these kind of Chamber of Commerce
candidates.
Yeah, this sort of fear mongering.
Yeah, there is supposed to be a firewall between editorial and actual news reporting. But as the Seattle Times, that really has disintegrated in the wake of the loss of the PI.
Yeah. So number three on my list is Mayor Durkin and city spokespeople kept talking about the record number of homeless people that they've housed this year. But the city can't seem to find accurate data to support that hype. The Human Services Department acknowledged in early March that the way they count exits from homelessness can actually double or triple count people. On the other hand, homeless service providers complain that when the city collects a separate set of statistics on service providers, it undercounts exits from homelessness by not counting when a homeless person moves in with a friend or family member or goes into transitional housing, because these are not counted as exits into permanent housing. So the city ends up financially penalizing homeless service providers for not meeting its metrics while giving themselves double or triple credit for city programs that really aren't working.
Particularly the voucher program, which, you know, you give a homeless person a voucher for market rate housing for 3 months, and then they can't afford that market rate housing afterwards and are back on the street. They have been counted for years by the city as permanent housing.
Yeah, that's where the double and triple counting comes in, people cycling through the system over and over again. And in the meantime, the mayor and city council just surrendered control of the city's homelessness services and the city's budget for homelessness services to a new regional authority in which they'll have a minority vote on the policies for dealing with homelessness. and while they provide the majority of the funding for it.
And interestingly, that was the main argument that was used by the business community to oppose the head tax in last year, that you know, we need to have a regional approach to this, the city shouldn't be going it alone, et cetera. Now that regional authority will be in place after the first of the year, it will be interesting to see when something like the head tax is inevitably reintroduced. I know Shama Sawant has already pledged to do that. Where that argument will go, mm-hmm. because the city's approach to homelessness overall is staggeringly counterproductive, as we were talking about with the biometrics.
Mm-hmm. Now, number four on my list is corporate money, particularly Amazon's money. This is a story that the mainstream press has been touting, is that corporate money sank the corporate-backed candidates in the most expensive city council elections ever, with well over $7 million spent in seven city council races. But in reality, I'd like to say I don't think it was only Amazon's money that sank these candidates, because the candidates were a mostly pretty mediocre bunch to begin with.
I can think of the three candidates that got the most corporate money. Actually, the four candidates that got the most corporate money. You had Phil Tavel in District 1, who kept saying stupid things.
Yes, and who lost and who did very poorly in a previous run in District 1.
Yes. In District 2, Mark Solomon. I talked to a District 2 resident who was a longtime friend, close friend of Mark Solomon. And you know, that person was saying, you know, I love Mark. He's a really nice guy. He would be totally in over his head on city council and voting for Tammy Morales.
Yeah, and he was coming from way far behind in that
yes.
election.
Egan Orion, I think, amply demonstrated that he was also in over his head. And then
he seemed to be particularly clueless about local political issues.
Yeah, and in District 6, of course, Heidi Wills also kept saying stupid things because, well, that's what she says.
Well, I think that's just who she is.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to say that. And then they also the Chamber of Commerce and Business PACs supported Michael George in District 7. And
who didn't even get out of the primary.
Yeah, he didn't even get out of the primary. And even in the primary, it was really clear to everybody in District 7 that he was just a shill for real estate developers and didn't have any other issues that he knew anything about.
And I think, you know, the best prepared of the chamber-backed candidates was Alex Peterson in District 4, who had been setting up to run for that seat for at least 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and got out very early, had a very well-organized campaign, and he almost got beat by Sean Scott, who ran a very good campaign, simply because I think there was the backlash there. But I think also, you know, these chamber-backed candidates just didn't represent what the city wanted.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the progressive candidates had some real advantages that the mainstream media is not talking about, which is their ability to recruit unpaid volunteers, highly
yes.
motivated and highly informed volunteers.
Yes.
They had experience
and
mobilizing people around local issues. So the candidates themselves were very, very knowledgeable. And most of them took part in the Democracy Vouchers program, which really helped to boost funding for them beyond what progressive candidates had been able to raise in most past elections. So
yeah.
Those are real advantages that the progressive candidates had that I think mainstream media is not talking about.
And the one candidate of the progressive candidates who didn't participate in the voucher program was Shama Sawant, who had a staggering number of volunteers this time around, I think at least 1,000,
mm-hmm.
and a solid fundraising base.
And that helped her with her fundraising, I think.
Yes.
Number five on my list is the issue that a lot of media kept talking about, a lot of urbanists in the city kept saying that turning the Showbox Theater into a historic landmark spells the end of affordable housing in Seattle. And I had to say that I never really got that argument. I never really understood the argument behind taking one building and saying, okay, we're not going to tear this building down and turn it into expensive luxury apartments with expensive retail on the ground floor is going to spell the end of affordable housing.
There was not affordable housing. That was part of that.
No, that was not part of that. And so every time an urbanist and a media outlet released an article with that argument, I just had to say, no, you know, you guys don't, you're not grasping it. I just don't understand it. We can absolutely have affordable housing, and we can preserve great music venues too, and great cultural venues too. We can have both. It's not that hard. So number six on my list is city politicians and the media still pushing for bogus transportation solutions like the City Connector streetcar, and Mayor Durkin getting on that bandwagon this year, even trying to divert a huge chunk of money from the sale of the Mercer Mega Block to build the City Connector streetcar. And only it seems only City Council diehard Lisa Herbold, who has been a critic of the streetcar system, seemed to be standing in the way of that. And this may be why the Chamber of Commerce threw so much money behind Phil Tavel, who appeared to me to be a pretty hopeless candidate in District 1 against Lisa Herbold, is I think because they want the City Connector streetcar and Herbold doesn't. Now, the costs of the streetcar are spiraling out of control. It was originally estimated to cost about $143 million. The estimate was revised in 2017 to $200 million. In August of last year, the estimate grew to $252 million. And early this year, the Seattle Department of Transportation calculated that it will cost at least $286 million. You can bet that it's above $300 million now. The line, which was projected to open in 2020, this coming year, is going to take at least until 2025 to complete. So it is clearly a money hole there, a money pit there.
A transportation project in Seattle that's a money pit? That's hard to believe.
Yeah.
That's because most major transportation projects in Seattle are real estate projects.
Yes.
And that's what this is too.
And the mainstream media continues to talk about them like their transportation solutions instead of gifts to developers.
Yeah.
Now, the final one on my list of overhyped stories is the Red Scare in Seattle politics. I have to say that I've heard all sorts of stupid, panicky things that people keep saying about our city this year. Everything from socialism is going to kill Seattle, to Seattle now has rent control, to, quote, those Reds are going to run Seattle out of business, end quote. And every time, it really seems to me at first to be a funny joke that they can't really be meaning that. And then I realize that the person who just said it is dead serious, and they're panicking. And I just have to say this in response. Look, knock it off, people. You know, enough is enough. Get your facts straight. Seattle is not dying. Seattle is not going to be killed by socialism. Just, you know, look at the facts and quit freaking panicking about our progressive city.
And not just Seattle, but, you know, most major urban centers in the United States now have a significant progressive component in their government. And those are the economic engines of this country. They're not being hurt by that at all.
Seattle is one of the most vibrant, has one of the most vibrant economies in the United States right now. And part of that is because of our progressive and inclusive politics. And let's start acknowledging that. Now, let's get to the most underreported local stories
this
year.
We won't get through all these. We'll have to continue probably, next week.
But at the top of my list is that, yes, the Seattle Police Department still engages in racial bias, according to their own report that they filed with the U.S. District Court in Seattle this year. It laid out the results of their own effort to measure racial bias in the Seattle Police Department's performance. And what that report found is that Hispanic and Asian Americans are frisked 6% more often than white people, African Americans 4% more often, but white people were more likely to be carrying weapons on them. Now, instances when an officer pointed his or her weapon at a suspect showed a big difference, too. They point their weapons more often, 9% more often, at Hispanic Americans and 4% more often at African Americans and Asian Americans than for white people, even though Hispanics are the least likely to have a weapon on them in a frisk.
And white people are the most.
And white people are the most. So, yes, the Seattle Police Department still does engage, even by their own statistics, in racial bias in policing. Now, number two on my list is the one-night count of the homeless gave us a really valuable picture of who the homeless are. And it blew away some myths that continue to get printed in mainstream media. 64% of the folks living on Seattle's streets have a medical condition. 36%, or well over one-third, have a mental health condition. Drug or alcohol addiction accounts for 32%, less than one-third of the folks living on the streets. And 23% have an obvious physical disability. About 37% reported that they're living with a disability that makes them unable to hold a steady job or take care of themselves from day to day. And when asked what they needed to get off the street, 64%, or almost two-thirds, said rental vouchers would help the most. 31% said housing affordability was the primary cause of their unhoused status. 24% said a job loss. 15% said eviction. 8% said they couldn't afford a rental increase. 6% were booted out by relatives or friends. And 2% suffered a foreclosure. You'll notice that the vast majority of those responses have to do with housing and housing costs. Outside of the 37% who were too disabled to work, 21% of the homeless have jobs. Okay. 21% more, about one in five, have jobs, while an additional 38% are looking for work. That's well over half the people living on the street. The remaining 4% of these folks may be the children or retired folks that were counted in the survey. So you have 37% who are too disabled, 21% who have jobs, and 38% looking for work, and then 4% who are probably kids or retired folks.
And what was the percentage that had substance abuse problems again?
It was less than one-third.
Yeah, and that's even...
32%.
Yeah, that's even a little misleading because it's a chicken and egg question, because some people start self-medicating when they're living on the streets because it's really hard.
Because it's really hard and really stressful. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a chicken and egg kind of thing.
Yeah, so that's a chicken and an egg kind of thing. Now, number three on my list is, while the mainstream media sneered at the Green New Deal introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives, local environmentalists pushed the Seattle City Council to pass a Green New Deal for Seattle in August, and the City Council then moved on to start proposing bills under that framework for dealing with climate change at the local level. And they're moving forward on setting up a Green New Deal advisory board. So the city is doing what the national government couldn't do, and they're taking it seriously. And that's a big news story this year that's gotten no mainstream press. And then number four on my list is, the city cut a sweetheart deal with Alexandria Real Estate Equities on the sale of a large 3-acre parcel of land along Mercer Street in South Lake Union, known as the Mercer Mega Block. Proposals by other developers would have built much more affordable housing than the Alexandria Real Estate Equities deal, but Alexandria owned two key parcels to the west and the south of the Mercer Mega Block that made this deal a huge profit maker for them. And Mayor Durkin and the city decided to, yes, they would go with Alexandria to cut that deal, and that it would allow them to boast about the little bit of affordable housing that Alexandria Real Estate is building, and it would give them the ability to use the proceeds from the sale to make big claims about the upcoming budget for 2020. In the meantime, the goal of more affordable housing for that plot really fell by the wayside.
So would you say, it would be fair to say that Alexandria played the city on
that
one?
I would say that that's a very fair estimate of what happened.
All right. It's 2 o'clock. Did you guys have any events for the week? I know it's holidays. It's hard to...
I didn't really have anything because people are busy with the holidays for some reason.
Yeah, Wednesday, December 25th, there was citywide all-day holiday community feast if you don't have anywhere else to go.
Oh, yeah, Washington Hall.
Yeah, that's at Washington Hall. That's hosted by the Seattle People's Party, Nikita Oliver, Feed the People, Chef Tariq Abdullah, and others. And volunteers are welcome, too. There will be multiple shifts to both work and to sit down and dine with other members of the community. That's from 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., again, on Wednesday and Christmas Day at Washington Hall, 153 14th Avenue, about a block and a half north of Yesler in the Central District.
Yeah, it's just by Seattle U.
Yeah, just by Seattle U.
Very cool yearly event they have created there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, so check that out if you are not having dinner with family or friends.
And we'll go through more of these next week. I'm sure that we'll have more time for it because nothing will really happen in the news.
Yeah. Yeah, everything else has been shut down.
Yeah. Yeah.
They promised. They promised. All right. So we'll look forward to having you both back here next week.
Oh, yes.
We'll be here.
Yes. All right.